Diamond Dogs by Bowie. Available on RCA Records and Tapes worldwide. Diamond Dogs by Bowie. A Main Man production.
So here I am with Stuart, but we're not together as we were in the previous episode. Obviously, with things the way they are, we are at different parts of the country, but we're still here, such as our determination to revisit Hunger City and to explore the world of the Diamond Dogs. Hi, Stuart. How are you?
Hi. It's kind of appropriate, really, isn't it? Because, I mean, there is a certain dystopian element to Diamond Dogs. and life does feel like a kind of movie a bit at the moment, doesn't it? But, you know, so it's kind of appropriate, I guess. But, yeah, well, anyway, here we are at a distance.
I think you are absolutely right. I mean, like, this isn't really the right conditions to be talking about the Laughing Gnome, but certainly Diamond Dogs. I think, you know, fate in all this misery and stress and hardship, I think, you know, one thing is true is that, yes, we can talk about Diamond Dogs and feel it a bit more than we did when we last spoke.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely, yeah. So, yes, so we're side two.
And side two is the 1984 side, really, isn't it? Because these are the songs which I'm assuming were left over or inspired by the original idea, which was to do the stage musical, the Broadway musical.
Well, yes, one would assume so. I mean, it is a very cohesive whole, really, the whole record. It's one of the things I love about it, that I love records that even if they're not a concept album as such, have some kind of, you know, some atmosphere, some shared atmosphere, some collective kind of vibe to them, which Diamond Dogs absolutely certainly has. And I guess, I don't know if it's too easy to say, I mean, side two is my favourite side. I love all the records, but side two is my favourite side. I don't know if it's too glib to say side one's kind of the rock, you know, the kind of glam rock, let's party in the ruin side, and this is more the, as I saw it described, I think, somewhere, the sort of slide into totalitarianism, you know, the dystopian side. Because I think those two things are going on all the way through Diamond Dogs, aren't they? There's this sense that he's still having fun with the tropes of glam rock, all these painted kids, you know, sort of being loose and wild in the ruins of these burning cities. And then there's also this, supposedly inspired by that epic trip he had back from the Japanese tour when he came to Russia.
He started somewhere in the wilds of Russia, went through East Berlin and ended up in Amsterdam.
That's right. And he's supposed to have, I get the impression from Bowie that he said it was the scariest thing he'd ever seen. I get the impression he was both titillated and horrified by it, you know, this.
Exactly.
And I think that informs this kind of side a bit as well, because there's some really, well, we'll come on to it, but there's some fantastic lyrics, I think, about power and what the nature of power is.
Was Iggy Pop with him? No.
I think we might come on to it, because Rock and Roll With Me was co-written with him. I think he was with Jeff McCormack, is he?
Warren Peace.
Who played on the records as Warren Peace, yes. Great name. I think it was an old childhood mate of his, wasn't he?
He was, yes. And you're absolutely right. So they were on the trip together. Bowie comes home and apparently says to Angie, his wife, like you said, I've never been so scared. That it really made a profound impact on him to go. And of course, at that period, we're talking about deep in the depths of the Soviet winter.
Yes.
So this was at the height of the Cold War. This was going through some really, really bleak, forbidding places. And of course, I think up to that point, Bowie had seen the flip side. He'd seen the glamour of the States. He'd been, you know, the fated pop star. Life had been wonderful. And here was something which was literally behind an iron curtain at the time.
And
to see that and to experience it close up, it really does permeate this side of the record, doesn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah, this is the darker side. There's no real, there are great tunes on this. There are in their own way sort of dystopian bangers, but there's nothing with that kind of loose swagger of Rebel Rebel or Diamond Dogs itself. So, and I think that was definitely the trip that you're right. That was the guy who was on the trip with him, who I think co-writes, if I'm not mistaken, Rock and Roll With Me, the opening track on side two.
He does. I just have to say, I love dystopian bangers. I think if I form a band, I've just got to call it dystopian bangers. Yes. He writes Rock and Roll With Me, which start now. This is a sort of, it's a bit of a big sing along, isn't it? But it starts off with this really lovely little riff. Do you think this has sort of been copped a bit off Lean On Me by the late Bill Withers?
I've seen that said. I think it is a little bit. I think there's lots of interesting things about this song, I think. It's got rock and roll in the title. I mean, the record starts with a reference to rock and roll. You know, this ain't rock and roll, this is genocide. Yeah. The record starts like that. And I think it's very interesting when you get someone as clearly as intelligent as Bowie talking about rock and roll. Because he doesn't mean it, I guess. I don't think he means it at all in the same way that, say, the Ramones would mean it. You know what I mean? Because with them, it's a very uncomplicated, straightforward thing. Rock and roll, it's a great thing, man. Mm. I think for someone as smart as Bowie, possibly even for someone as smart as Jagger, when they refer to it, it means it's something else. They're playing with some kind of trope, I think, about what does rock and roll mean? Is it a particular element of what they do? Is it the sexy, fun side of what they do? Or is it a whole kind of art idea in their head? I just don't know quite what it is. It isn't as straightforward as it would be, you know, with like Kiss or the Ramones, definitely. So it's because it must be some kind of cerebral take on it. And it's interesting, I was thinking about this, that rock and roll in its early days, as used as a concept, people like Little Richard, who would sing about rock and roll unselfconsciously, but then they're quite complicated people as well. You know, Little Richard was gay and was a not out gay man and that sort of stuff. So he must be thinking of rock and roll as an abstract kind of artistic idea to aim towards. And I think you're right. I think there's, this reminds me in some ways. And I looked into this and found out that apparently he was listening to a lot of Springsteen at the time.
Springsteen, didn't he?
This amazes me that apparently he was playing a particular, is it Spirit in the Night, a particular Springsteen song constantly during the sessions. And I think you can hear a bit of Springsteen in this, not even to say predating, a bit of Meatloaf and Jim Steinman in this. It's got that.
The epic big
power ballad.
Feel.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Big pop power ballad, operatic show tune almost element to it. And I think that's, you know, that's a really interesting thing that you're doing, because obviously this is the side where we think most of the songs came from, those abandoned musical projects. So, and I can hear it, I can really hear it in this.
Exactly. Can't you? This would be a big showstopper tune, wouldn't it?
Oh yes, this would have been, as they say, you know, that, you know, you need a big song in the second, beginning, start of the second act or whatever, and this would have been it. I imagine. And it does remind one level, thinking about it, Springsteen and Meatloaf are about as far away from Bowie as you can get. Your initial reaction is to think, oh no, absolutely not. We think of Springsteen as this working class poet, poet of the streets, man of the people, the voice of the every guy, you know, the blue collar everyman. And Bowie's this weird, rarefied, alien emissary kind of thing. But then after thinking about it, there's quite a lot of this other stuff that they're both celebrating the glamour of youth and the romance of rock and roll in a way. So I think there are more similarities. They're both quite theatrical in their different ways. I think there is a, you know,
escapism is very much at the heart of what
escapism is perhaps the best way of putting it. You're absolutely right. Yeah. And I'm fascinated by the idea that he was playing. I would guess what would it have been in 74? It would have been, well, it's before Born to Run. So he's playing maybe those first two albums of Springsteen's all the time, because I'm sure a lot of David Bowie fans, think of themselves, the more arty end of the David Bowie fan base, I think we'll probably think, oh, Bruce Springsteen, isn't he a terrible, you know, greasy mechanic kind of rock and roll? And it's interesting, I think, to know that Bowie was into it. And you can hear that. You can definitely hear that in this song. You said that thing about it being on Lean On Me. And I can well imagine that, because again, I think apparently the genesis of the song is the aforementioned War and Peace, Jeff McCormack, just tootling around on the piano at Bowie's house, wasn't it? And it came out of that. That's apparently the genesis. So I can well understand that someone like him would be thinking, oh, look, I can play Lean On Me, you know, on the piano. And Bowie thinking, hey, you know, like Hollywood musical style, we've got ourselves a song here, you know.
Let's do the show right here, kids.
Exactly. The other thing I think is very interesting about this record is I've seen that it's supposed to be about his fans. That it's a love song. Yeah, that it comes over as a very, very heartfelt love song. Unusually for Bowie, an uncomplicatedly heartfelt love song, it seems to me. But it's apparently about his fans. And I was thinking, it's interesting the relationship musicians have with their fans. Very few of them sing unambiguously with songs of love towards their fans. I was trying to think who does it. Morrissey does it. Now, Morrissey, now I know he's a problematic figure for so many reasons, but he's always had felt
what,
he's
had, in his solo career or in the Smiths.
Often in interviews and in songs has said, you know, that this song is about my fans. That he feels that they're the one group of people who give him unmitigated, unconditional love and support when the world is against him. I don't think Bowie's ever felt the world's against him. But if I get the similar kind of vibe from this, contrast it with when most bands sing about their fans, particularly when they've got big enough to have a big fan base, it's very ambivalent relationship with them. You know, that Pink Floyd The Wall kind of song. They're often songs that sort of slightly suspicious of their fans, who think their fans are, you know, making them do things they don't want to do or are putting them on a pedestal. But this seems to be an unambiguous love song to his fans, if that is the case. I've tried to find like direct citation where he's actually said it's about my fans. I can't find that anywhere, but I can find lots of critics who seem to assume that it's about his fans.
Yeah, I've seen that as well, and I kind of agree with it to a point. I think certainly there's a degree of affirmation there that, you know, you make me, you validate me, you set my theatre and my imagination, my creativity is all validated by you, and so that's, you know, that, and it's not a fan song as Rock and Roll Suicide was, which I think was very much the kind of Messiah style fan song.
Yes.
Give me your hands. Yeah. 1, 2, 3, rock and roll.
That's right.
A concept, isn't it? It's like a high concept. Like he would juggle with any concept. He would juggle with the nihilism of 1984, or he'd juggle with kabuki theatre, or he'd juggle with film being an influence. Rock and roll is a part of that jigsaw altogether.
Exactly. That's exactly right. It isn't a sort of end in itself. It isn't It isn't sort of three chords and loud music. It is a whole artistic idea of youth and freedom and the part of himself that's, you know, that's sexy, that's wild, that's all those things that fits into the jigsaw of his artistic personality, along with his interest in kabuki theatre or whatever. You know, it's part of it. Is, you know, he's saying there's a rock and roll, you know, the rock and roll, that sense of creative freedom is something that obviously, I mean, and it's his chosen milieu, isn't it? I mean, one would like to think David Bowie, a smart enough guy, probably to have been lots of things. He probably could have been an actor or a graphic designer or whatever, but he chose rock and roll. That was a career choice. So obviously there's something in the whole silly, trivial, romantic nonsense of it that he loves.
Didn't he say, I mean, I don't know if it was at this point or later in his career, that rock and roll was that was just what was available to me. I could have been an actor, I could have been, you know, a painter, I could have been any one of these things. Rock and roll was just the vehicle for me.
Well, it's a bit like, I guess you see that with a lot of people, don't you? You think if that person hadn't become a rock and roll person, they would have become an actor or they would have become a writer or something else. And usually that's the kind of person who ends up doing those things as well in their career. But I suppose it's like that old cliche about, you know, working class kids had, you know, they used to say, you know, working class kids from the north could either become boxers or footballers. That was their way out of. And I guess music is that at one point it was music as well. So working class kids from the big cities of England could get out also by being in bands, you know. And for a long time, that's what did happen. It was a working class pursuit. It's very much changed now, but it did used to be, as I think I've said before, I might have said it in the first podcast. You only have to look at the class landscape you only have to look at the names to see how the class landscape of music has changed. The 60s rock aristocrats are all called things like Ken and Dave and Eric and Bill. And now they're all Hugos and Orlandos. I mean, I know that's quite a reductive argument, but it does show you that the class landscape of who makes music has changed.
Just one last thing I want to say is, yes, rock and roll is mentioned in the title. I read somewhere that he really, before he recorded Diamond Dogs, he really sat down for a couple of months and practiced the hell out of his guitar. He got really, really good at it. And he said, I had to get my chops together. I couldn't hear anyone else making this music. I had to make it myself. And to do that, I had to improve radically, very quickly. So that also is something interesting in light of what we're talking about, how he, you know, became this, you know, became really a rock musician. Perhaps at this time.
You can hear, I mean, I know that that Alan Parker plays on some of the tracks, but I think where Bowie's playing, you can really hear as well in that slightly artless, I should say really not technically super skilled way. You can hear, I definitely think, the beginnings of that same kind of untutored but brilliant creative spirit that you hear not only in the best punk musicians, but then going forward in like Thurston Moore or whatever. You know, you can hear the sort of beginnings of that kind of sort of art rock guitar playing. Yeah,
definitely, because this album, in many ways, is that if you want to find a link between glam and punk. There's a lot to find in this album, isn't there?
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
Say that DIY ethos, that sense of doing it yourself, that it's rough around the edges, a few of the seeds of, say, indie, 80s indie, 90s indie, Sonic Youth, Noise.
Yes. I think he is prefiguring a lot of people who were to come, who were more interested in what they could make the guitar do than showing off the, you know, sort of regurgitating sort of blues licks sort of thing.
Absolutely.
It's a very different, with no disrespect to Eric Clapton, it's a very different way of playing the guitar from, say, Eric Clapton or Dave Gilmour or whatever, you know, so, yeah.
That said, the beginning of the next track has always reminded me of Supertramp.
Yes.
It does, isn't it? That electric piano.
The electric piano.
Yeah.
The electric piano and We Are the Dead. This is the track that reminds me most on the record. I think I said in the last podcast, because when I first heard Tranquility Bay Hotel and Casino by Arctic Monkeys, when I first heard that, my instant reaction was, I said, this is the Diamond Dogs, because I think everything about it has such parallels. I think that it's, you know, young, working class, very creative lad who's become a major rock star at this point, major world rock star, makes his dystopian sci-fi record, you know, full of, and I think there is a lot of that, but this one really reminds me of the Arctic Monkeys. Maybe it's the electric piano, this, the sly lyrics, the cut-up lyrics, because this is one, We Are the Dead is very much.
This is a cut-up.
The cut-up one, isn't it? Because he'd been inspired by Burroughs, and he'd met Burroughs, and he'd done these cut-ups. And I think you can hear, I love Tranquility Bay Hotel and Casino. I think it's a masterpiece. I think in the fullness of time, people will see it as a masterpiece. And what I love about it is you get these disembodied great lines in it. And it's almost as if it's that idea of cut-ups where you're more interested in, not random, but these disjointed, brilliant images that come at you rather than a whole. Having said that, it's another love song, isn't it? This presumably would have been a tender love ballad between Winston and Julia in the 1984 musical, because We Are the Dead is an actual quote of Winston's from 1984, isn't it?
It's the climatic scene of the book in many ways. It's when Winston and Julia are discovered, and they're in their secret hideaway, and Winston's musing on their love set against this, you know, nightmarish backdrop, and then they find that they've been caught. We are the dead. We are the dead. They all repeat the line, we are the dead.
Yeah, absolutely. So it has got this, it's both a deeply pessimistic song and a kind of tender song, isn't it? It's a love song. I mean, he didn't play this. This is the one song from Diamond Dogs. He didn't play on the Diamond Dogs tour.
I know, that's surprising. It's one of my favourites, actually. It's just gorgeous, absolutely really lovely atmosphere and that darkness to it. But I don't think he's ever played this live.
It's strange, isn't it? Because it's not, sometimes you can see why people don't play things live. They're too cumbersome, they're too impractical, they've got too many multi-tracked voices on them or whatever. There wouldn't seem to be any good reason why he couldn't play this live. And I wonder why that is. That maybe it reminds him too closely of the, you know, abandoned project. Because I know he was very angry with Sonny Orwell.
He was gutted about that, yeah.
I love that quote he said about, he told some interviewer about, you know, he said, for someone who married a socialist who was almost a communist, she was the most appalling stuck up snob I've ever met.
Absolutely. She was really dismissive, wasn't she? Wasn't there a film adaptation of this in the 50s? And that apparently set her off.
Apparently, I don't know that at all. I've never, the only one I know is the bloody 1980s one with the Eurythmics. I don't know this 50s. The one with John Hurt.
There's a 50s one.
Not with Peter Cushing.
I don't know.
Why am I getting the idea that Peter Cushing now played Winston in either a TV adaptation? I'll check that in a moment. I think there might have been a 50s one with Peter Cushing, but I thought, if I'm right, I thought that was critically quite well thought of, but anyway.
Really?
I mean, obviously not by Sonia Orwell, no.
Do you remember something that O'Brien said? We are the dead.
We are the dead.
You are the dead. Remain exactly where you are. Make no movement until you are ordered.
If it was only an outlet fancy, it passed like an ivory day. But a look...
I suppose we may as well say goodbye.
You may as well say goodbye.
They've got a ladder.
I think there was another quote from her saying, why would anyone want to set music to that?
I know. So, I think we forget as well that the gap between pop music, the pop music has become respectable now to the degree that we'd be very surprised if a modern novelist were to say, oh, God, pop music, I can't stand it. But in the 70s, that wasn't the case. I'm reminded, a rather niche interest of mine, of progressive rock. There's a progressive, brilliant, cult progressive rock album, The Lord of the Rings, by a Swedish musician called Bo Hansson, which I love. And apparently Tolkien, when he heard it, loathed it. And when you hear it, it's such a gentle record that you can't see why he'd loathed it. But I think it was simply that people of Tolkien and Sonia Orwell's generation really were raised on chamber music and Edwardian parlour ballads, and anything to do with amplified music was anathema to them.
And also, it's an entirely different world. I mean, weren't there people talking about doing Lord of the Rings adaptations in the late 60s, starring Twiggy and Mick Jagger and all things like that? And
do you know the Beatles?
Yes.
The Beatles thought about doing it with the four of them as the four hobbits, which is extraordinary, isn't it?
Can you imagine?
Presumably Ringo would be Sam. Presumably Paul would be Frodo. And then, I can't remember the Lord of the Rings well enough to know who the other two are, the elves. But that's extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah. I'm guessing that one of them, probably Paul, maybe George, is lying around with someone's told him, hey, you should read this far out new thing, man. Actually, it could have been any of them, really, couldn't it? And said, hey, we could be the hobbits, like. So, but that would have been amazing, wouldn't it? The Beatles are the hobbits.
The Beatles stars the hobbits. Wow. Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, it's a fantastic idea. But yeah, obviously Sonia Orwell, just point blank thought, who is this, probably, who is this upstart from Brixton who wants to besmirch this great piece of work, yeah.
And look at him. This is, I mean, obviously he'd been swanning around with his carrot top and his, look, which must have terrified people over 60 in those days. And here he was wanting to do 1984. But he did go quite far down that road. I mentioned last time that we spoke, he had been putting together dummies, models of the Hunger City he wanted to use. Did you see at the V&A show? They actually had
some
of the replicas of Hunger City. He got quite far down the road of doing 1984, and he had, like you were talking about the Arctic Monkeys, he had come to that point, right, I've got Ziggy down, I've done the big glam rock superstar thing, now here's what I want to do. This is really what I want to do. And he was saying in an interview a few years later, well, obviously I had the money, I thought I had the money to do it. As it turned out, I was bankrupt, but I didn't know it.
Okay.
And when the thing came, when the project came screeching to a halt, obviously, yeah, he was devastated. But here we are. So this is really fascinating. What could these songs are seeds of what could have been unbelievable. I mean, We Are the Dead itself, creeping terror, very sinister. Again, that lovely Mike Garson piano. But you can imagine, again, you can imagine this on stage, can't you? You can imagine.
Oh, you absolutely can. You absolutely can.
The lights and the cast circling around and the dread coming in. Yeah, it would have been amazing.
And before we leave it, we should say, apparently, he wanted this to be the title track, as in originally, he was going to call the album We Are the Dead.
Oh.
I read this somewhere that he was going to call the album We Are the Dead. And balked at the last minute, I think, same because he thought there might be legal problems, I guess, because it's an actual quote from 1984. Mm. But I also think as well, it might be that they thought, you know, calling an album We Are the Dead is quite a downbeat thing to do to your record company. You know, your record company, hey, what's the new record called, David? We Are the Dead. Oh, great, you know.
The latest from David Bowie. We are the dead.
Exactly.
But and at number two, it's Jimmy Osmond.
he said that he thought that he would get into trouble, you know, presumably because it's an actual an actual quote from 1984, yeah.
Do you think he ever considered just calling the album 1984?
Well, presumably, I guess he'd have run into similar problems. I don't know, would he?
You can't copyright 1984.
I don't think you can copyright a date, can you? No. So maybe he wouldn't. Or maybe he just didn't want to make it so obvious that, hey, this was a project of mine that failed, you know. So
I guess so, and then also, Sonia Orwell's lawyers would have been watching keenly.
Absolutely.
So I imagine all of this stuff, the creativity has been kept within within legal parameters, which is quite an interesting idea.
Yeah.
But then speaking of 1984, that's obviously the next track. And
This is my favourite.
Yeah.
Well, I know that everybody, and quite understandably, lots of people think the Sweet Thing Candida medley, as it were, is the best thing on the record. But for me, the best 8 minutes on the record are the next 8 minutes, because These are such interesting records, starting with 1984. Now, here's the most obvious manifestation of Bowie's burgeoning and ongoing, but getting stronger and stronger all the time, interest in black music and what was happening in black clubs and on black radio. But it's such a... The mixture of things in this song in 1984 is so interesting, in that you have got the absolute climate of fear and terror of totalitarianism sweeps through the disco. That's what it feels like, doesn't it? It's a disco record. It's absolutely a disco record, but a disco record that's drenched in kind of fear. It's extraordinary. When you talked about Rock and Roll With Me, and you said you can almost hear, you can see the dance moves and things like that. This is the one I always, in an almost jokey way. If you have a relationship like mine with musical theatre, it's a bit ambivalent. Then the beginning of 1984, whilst it's absolutely brilliant, I also these days cannot hear it without seeing dancers scampering across the stage, you know, searchlights, people doing something. If they'd got this wrong, this could have been a rather naff dance sequence, I think, at the beginning of 1984.
But that surprise face and moving
exactly,
their hands around. Yeah.
Exactly, people doing that face, you know, caught in the searchlights, you know.
Yeah.
You can sort of see it being a sort of nightmarish version of Cats, really, the opening of 1984.
Yeah, definitely.
But this is a fascinating song, I think. I suppose at this point, it's interesting that at this point, we've had this, there's been a kind of cross-fertilisation going between white rock and black music for a while. A lot of black musicians have taken on ideas from white rock. I suppose Stevie Wonder is the most notable, who's saying, look, I'm making concept albums, I'm using synthesizers and stuff like that. Whether it was going the other way, whether the traffic was two-way, I think maybe Bowie was one of the first to say that. I mean, I'm intrigued that he went to the... He went to either the producer or the... Is it Ken Scott?
Ken Scott did this, yeah.
I'm interested that he said to him, I want some of those Barry White strings.
Yes.
Now, I at the time, I would have thought Bowie would have been unique, alone in the world of white rock, of not thinking of Barry White as anything other than a novelty act, which he absolutely wasn't. But the way he was presented in the British media at the time, I remember because I was a little kid, it was all those jokes about the walrus of love and all those kind of things, that he was this rather silly, big, fat man making these sort of, you know, lubricious ballads. And he was not regarded critically outside of the black community, where he was regarded really highly, and the disco community and the gay community. But Bowie's smart enough to have seen that, and they absolutely are those, well, what you could call the Barry White strings, the Philadelphia sound, the sound that would later be on the Chic records. And it's great, but they're not used. Usually strings on records, especially by, again, white rock musicians, are there to give it some sentimentality or some added gravitas. So you can hear, since the 60s onwards, white rock groups who've made a fairly ordinary record, stick some strings on it, it'll sound good. But here they're not used like that at all. Here they are used to invoke an atmosphere of paranoia and threat and urgency. They are not sexy, they aren't sentimental, they aren't lush, they are panicked, you know what I mean?
That's really true. I mean, they sound like they've come out of a kind of blaxploitation soundtrack. You know, I mean, obviously there's the real Isaac Hayes influence here as well.
Yes, absolutely.
I hadn't thought about that, what you're saying about white rock bands, white rock musicians. They haven't really appropriated anything beyond the superficial strings as a sort of passive thing. But I don't know. I mean, like, would the Stones have been cutting? No, Fingerprint File came later. You know, that real, you know, funky track thing with lots of wah-wah. But came a little bit later, didn't it, on its own rock and roll?
They did. And later on, the Stones and Rod Stewart, with varying degrees of success, would try and make a disco record. So you get Miss You and Do You Think I'm Sexy? But nobody has done it this well. Yeah. Nobody has made it not sound like a novelty record, but a perfectly, just a great record. And apparently, again, I was looking into this, and apparently he'd moved house recently from, is it Haddon Hall to Oakley Street? He'd moved house, and he'd started to frequent a couple of discos in Kensington, which played what would then be, I guess, the first 12-inch singles. Or there were records made for DJs in clubs, because we're getting, I guess, the very first underground stirrings of disco, but it's still mainly amongst gay people, it's still mainly amongst black people. And although I guess in Kensington it would have been fairly well-heeled black and gay people. But So he's even, I guess, I think what might be the very first 12-inch singles, which are records by, you know, Barry White, Eddie Kendricks, and people like that, and the Temptations, with extended instrumental breaks. And he's going to these clubs, and you can hear that this is feeding into his consciousness. And Bowie, with that kind of quivering antenna he always had, have thought, this is the coming thing. So he'll have cottoned onto disco 2 years before disco became went overground, you know.
That's really interesting. I didn't realise that he was already soaking it up in that sense. I would have thought that he just heard records coming, like you said, the Barry White Love Unlimited Orchestra strings.
No, I jotted it down somewhere here. He's going to a place called Sombreros in Kensington, apparently, which was very well frequented by the gay scene at the time. Apparently he was hanging out in these places and was soaking all this stuff up, yeah.
And he brings all this, all these influences that he's been soaking up, he brings this whole milieu, which would have been very new to a lot of his audiences, wouldn't it? I mean, certainly in the mainstream of British chart music, to hear not only just a few superficial references to disco, but in the entire genre summarised in this wonderful, edgy, funky track.
Exactly.
It must have blown the socks off, say, kids like yourself in those days where, you know, you just hadn't been exposed at that age to something this intense. It must have blown people's socks off.
It must have. I mean, it's hard to understand why, to me, these next two tracks, particularly 1984, I'm always amazed why they aren't regarded, well, I suppose because they weren't big hit singles, but aren't regarded as kind of some of the greatest things in his canon, you know what I mean? Right up there with, for me, you know, when people talk about the great Bowie tunes, they'll talk about Life on Mars and they'll talk about Heroes and stuff like that, but these two tunes are right up there with them. Maybe it's because of the atmosphere of kind of darkness and paranoia that fills the record. Maybe they're just a little bit too nervy and edgy for people, you know, to get played on the radio, you know.
It definitely is very, very nervy and edgy. And that's quite ironic, isn't it? We're talking about disco, the music that grew out of soul music, that, you know, which is so much about, you know, emotion and feeling. Here, being pressed into the service of darkness, death, fear, paranoia.
Absolutely.
And what does he...
mean when he said, I'm searching for the treason that I knew in 65. I never know. It's such a great line, but I don't know what he means.
Is it treason? I always thought it was reason.
Oh, is it?
I think, I don't know. I mean, I was going to say to you, is it savage lure or savage jaw?
Because,
again, that's one I've seen it written both ways. Beware the savage jaw of 1984.
Oh, wow. I don't know. Well, that's interesting. What was treason or reason? What was it about 65 then? If it's reason, then it's a different mindset altogether. It's kind of saying I want to go back to my youthful urgency or whatever, innocence. But yeah, that's interesting.
But was this written with cut up lyrics as well, this track?
I'm not sure if it is. I've not seen that, but it might well be. Yeah, yeah. And he said, there's one interesting thing. Lester Bangs said, he said, if you go, and this must have, Bowie, I don't know if this would have upset Bowie. Lester Bangs said, he's quite right. He said, that, you know, if you go into a gay club, you'll hear Barry White, you won't hear Rebel Rebel. And I don't understand what he means, that white musicians might be thinking, oh, we're cutting edge, but they're not really. And Bowie would have been desperate from then on to be cutting edge and get his records played in those clubs, you know what I mean? And 1984 is the first step to that, yeah.
It definitely is. And then, of course, you could say that he kind of got that when he did Golden Years and Soul Train.
Absolutely.
Wasn't he the first white performer on Soul Train?
It was the first white performer on Soul Train. We're now going into the whole, you know, as he said, relentless plastic soul. If it is true, when he says that thing about relentless plastic soul, which is his next phase, and Golden Years and Young Americans, and you can kind of hear it on Young Americans, but I don't think there's anything plastic about 1984. I think it is just a brilliantly realised, frightening disco rock record, you know.
It's definitely got the authenticity of that guitar all the way through, and just the structure of it, the swooping strings, the vocalizing on the middle eights, the bridges. It leaves you literally hanging in suspense with that tick-tocking outro.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
I think it's just one of its most powerful, powerful songs. I love, by the way, I love the live version that you get on, I think it's David Live. Yeah.
Yes.
The live version is just such an epic. And again, you know, revisiting that theme of the musical, once we get past Once we get past the scared faces and the jazz hands at the beginning,
yes.
I think this would have been just such a wonderful centerpiece. But to go back to what you said, so let's look at these lyrics then. So 1965 obviously was the very beginning of his career. He was a young mod around town, listening to a lot of soul music, immersing himself in black music. He was listening to a lot of R&B, a lot of soul, and he was trying to bring that to his fledgling career.
Of course, he
was a King Bee at that point, wasn't he?
Was he a King Bee? Certainly,
he
made R&B.
Yeah,
he made R&B records with the Manish Boys as well, didn't he? So, yes, he would have been. This is interesting digression. We talked then about the dialogue, the conversation between white rock and black music, and although most bands, Bowie's generation of musicians, even the ones who became the titans of progressive rock, pretty much all started in R&B bands. And that's a really interesting thing Bowie did. Jethro Tull and Van de Graaff Generator. Now, you would say you cannot imagine more white, if you like, grammar school progressive rock acts than that.
Yeah.
But all of those bands, you know, Jethro Tull started playing soul music in the clubs in Blackpool. Similarly, Van de Graaff Generator played modern soul clubs in Manchester. They all have got that grounding, really. And Bowie's exactly the same. They sort of... It's something you just had to do to make a living back in the day. And they all wanted to be, you know, their first loves as singers that were the great black singers. They all wanted to be Wilson Pickett, really, you know.
That's a reference directly to 1965.
Yeah, maybe that's what he's talking about. Maybe he's talking about his early loves of black music, yeah.
Where do you stand on the whole Savage Jaw, Savage Lore?
I'm never sure, because I've also thought in the past when I've been listening to this record when I was a kid that it was Savage Dawn or Savage Door. So
enter a third option.
So it's ambivalent. We'll see the ambivalence really strongly on the next track, but it's the ambivalence again as being petrified of what's coming and slightly excited by it, I think. And that's very much, I think, where Bowie's head was.
God, it's so dark, isn't it? They'll split your pretty cranium and fill it full of air and tell you that you're 80, but brother, you won't care. Because you'll be shooting up on anything because tomorrow's never there. Beware the Savage Jaw / Law of 1984.
yeah.
It's kind of got that the atmosphere, a little bit of Driving Saturday for some reason for me. I mean, obviously it's much, much darker, but it's got something of Driving Saturday. In fact, quite a few songs on this album to me are building on seeds, embryonic ideas that were there in the previous album.
I can hear that. Yes, it has got, because there are tracks on the previous album, Driving Saturday, Panic in Detroit, that have that sense of urban paranoia going through them as well, aren't they? And I suppose if we talk about urban paranoia, that's with Ziggy, doesn't it? I mean, nothing much more paranoid than a record that starts with someone saying, you know, we've got 5 years left. So yeah, paranoia, I think. Paranoia, perhaps not helped by some of his recreational habits at the time, is running through his work, isn't it? Yeah.
The recreational habits, which I was reading about the other day, the recreational habits, by his own admission at this point, were getting to the point where people were getting concerned about me.
Yes.
And in fact, he was recording, I think he recorded this album in Olympic in London around January, February 74.
That's right.
Then, because Main Man, his production company, which was an absolute nightmare, hadn't paid the bills, they had to leave and go and finish the album in Hilversum in Holland.
Yes.
And by that point, hadn't been in touch with Visconti, his old friend and producer, for a while. And Visconti then got a phone call from a clearly very, very refreshed David Bowie, you know, someone. He said he could barely understand what he wanted at first, but he was obviously very excited. So then they moved the operations back to Visconti's home studio, which Bowie actually kitted out for him, courtesy of Habitat.
Right.
Because Visconti was building a studio in his basement, and he was literally sitting on a couple of old, planks while they were putting the studio in. And Bowie came over and had presented him with a nearly finished album. And I think Visconti did the strings for 84. I love this little story, which is that Bowie looked around this very Spartan studio, and then the next day a Habitat van showed up and out came dining tables, dinner service, chairs, wine glasses, plates, luxury chairs for the mixing consoles, everything. And Bowie's saying, oh, it's just a little something. There you go, little housewarming. And I think obviously a big side effect of ingesting that amount of cocaine is this paranoia, which obviously served him well in the sense that that was definitely the mood he was looking for, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, you have to say, hey, we can't on this podcast be condoning the use of Class A pharmaceuticals.
No, not at all.
I mean, you would have to say that if ever it added to the success creatively of a record, it would be here, because that mood of jittery paranoia that runs through 1984. Well, you wouldn't want a record based on 1984 that had been recorded on claret. You know, would you, in a way? You don't want a smooth and reflective record, do you, I suppose?
Stuart, Tony Visconti, in his memoirs, remembered that every night they would get food deliveries to eat on this new table, and they would actually drink claret.
Really? Oh, what a strange choice.
That's in his autobiography. He would drink claret.
What a strange choice of thing. Interesting footnote about the studios, and I didn't know this, I read it just a few days ago. Olympic in Barnes was where, you're absolutely right, the bulk of the record was made. And then when they had the financial problems, they went to this little studio in Hilversum, the famous radio town in the Netherlands. Both those studios, when he had to move, Olympic in Barnes was the Stones' studio of choice. And when he had to move, as a second choice, he chose also a studio that the Stones used a lot. And which adds fuel to the fire that at that point, he might have been obsessed with Bruce Springsteen and black music musically, but on a personal competitive level, he certainly had a thing about Jagger and the Stones at the time.
Oh, you know, God, yes, absolutely. Last time we talked about the whole debacle over the cover, where he got the same artist, the Dutch artist, to do the cover, and Jagger was really, really pissed off.
Yes.
And now he's even using the same studio.
Yes. So he certainly was... Jagger was very much in his thinking at the time, we should say, yeah.
But then we can say, I just mentioned Fingerprint File, the Stones song, which is very similar in the sense that it's immersed in that genre from the States at the time. And that must have been recorded about now as well.
I guess so,
It could very well be. That's Jagger listening to 1984 and thinking, right, well, you know, I'm going to show him.
Yeah, absolutely. Right, in a sort of in a Satanic Majesty's Request style.
Absolutely,
we can do that. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think 1984 for me has always been absolutely. Yeah. Like you said, it's another one of your
dystopian bangers. Yeah,
dystopian. Yeah. And there's three more for them in session later, but it's definitely another dystopian banger. This leads us on now to Big Brother, which is obviously named after the figure in the 1984 novel.
Absolutely.
I think this is another one where the cut-up technique has been employed. And I've got a lot of time for this song.
This is my favourite song on the album.
Is it?
This is my favourite track.
Not 1984?
Not 1984. This is the one, you know, if I had to take one of these records away, it would be this, because I absolutely... The darkness of this in the... Well, the ambivalence of it again, because it is, again, I think you can hear in this Bowie both being horrified and slightly titillated by the notion of that future that could come. There's a line, Orwell used this line about the mysterious, calm power of Big Brother.
Yeah.
And I think you can hear that in this. It's not just a record saying, oh, God, Big Brother's coming, it's going to be terrible. He's welcoming in it in some way, isn't he? Because there's those beautiful kind of, it sounds like a mellotron, but I think it's Bowie's voice, it must be multi-tracked. There's like that chorale start to it that's almost like him, you know, all that's going through it all the time. It's a beautiful record about a terrible subject. And I think there's a certain amount of, it's almost hymnal. There's a kind of hymn-like quality to it, I think. And I just love the lyric of the someone to claim us, someone to follow, someone to shame us, some brave Apollo, someone to fool us. That is so great. I think you can hear all his weird ambivalent feelings about totalitarianism in here. Without being reductive and getting stupid, I think there was something about the weirdness of the totalitarian world, the uniforms, the broadcasts, the architecture, that slightly appealed to his slightly otherly sensibility.
He was crazy for it.
While at the same time, I think, realizing whilst at the same time that someone like him would never prospers under totalitarian governments, you know, people who like dressing up in women's clothing and flirting with, you know, bisexuality never do well under totalitarian governments.
But
I think some would argue something trivial in his personality, something self-indulgent in his personality, quite like the uniforms at a very stupid level, you know what I mean? Yeah.
He loved the aesthetic of it, as we see when it comes to 1976, and there's an unfortunate greetings at Victoria Station and all the rest of it. But there was definitely something about it that, on a purely aesthetic level, he just connected with. And here's the concept of The Dictator. This is a wonderful song that sums up the simultaneous ecstasy of surrender to this, you know, the calming Big Brother figure. And of course, in the book, the tension is with Winston Smith's unwillingness, inability, reluctance, absolute demented refusal to accept Big Brother. And the state, in the form of O'Brien, is beating him down, beating him down, beating him down. And you get that simultaneous bliss, that ecstasy and the fear. And I, like you say, that's a wonderful line, someone to fool us.
Someone to fool us, yeah.
Some brave Apollo, someone to fool us.
It's fantastic. The interesting words you use there, because again, another quote from Orwell I saw used in relation to this, the hideous ecstasy of fear is something that Orwell said about the mood of 1984. We'll build a glass asylum with just a hint of mayhem. He's both repelled and attracted, isn't he, by what this future world could look like and the sheer craziness of it. And I do think that apparently, again, hardly ever played live. Whereas you can't get why on, whereas with We Are the Dead, we couldn't understand why. I can understand on this because it's almost his most architecturally proggy as well. There is a lot going on in this song.
Yeah.
There is a lot going on. The bit I've never really liked that weird throwback bridge that comes in for a second. You know, the one that sounds
it's
a bit like something from Space Oddity.
Jarring. Yeah, I know. It's I don't know why that's here. I listened to it again this morning and I just was thinking
it's weird, just
really jars the mood. I don't know what the intention is with that.
It only works for me as a way of reminding you how great the someone to click, because it comes back in. It only serves to sort of stop for a second. Yeah. And so you can hear that bit again. But it is very odd, and it's almost like his folky days again. And for me, that does not work except as a sort of drawing breath moment. But it's very fey, very hippie, and
I think you're right. It must be just to give some dynamic to the structure, to sort of set off some tension again. But I don't. That's a bit weird.
It is an extraordinary thing. It's like, to me, it's like the architectural centerpiece of the record. I think it's all been building up to this because he's absolutely serious on this. I mean, some of the other tracks you can hear, there's an insouciance to Rebel Rebel and Diamond Dogs itself, and there's a tenderness to some of the, you know, to Rock and Roll With You or We Are the Dead. Mm-hmm. But this seems a very cold statement of what this record is about, both the attractions and the nightmarishness of totalitarianism. It sounds great as well.
It sounds really great. But yeah. When you were a teenager, when you first got into this album, did 1984, had that made a big impact on you? Had you read it as a teen, or did you get to it a bit later? Or
no, I'd read it at this point, I think, because it's just one of those, you know, I guess I maybe even in my early years at secondary school, read Animal Farm in 1984, because Orwell's always popular with young people, isn't he? Because he's not difficult to understand, and they're very powerful books. So I think I was familiar with Orwell, and I was a big fan of Orwell at the time anyway, so I'd have been into him. But, so I would have known a little about it. I think even if you don't, you can still enjoy it. I'm sure there are people around the world enjoying this record who've never heard of George Orwell.
Yeah.
But in fact, there's probably someone, even as we speak, in lockdown, reading 1984 and saying, God, this is all ripped off Diamond Dogs by David Bowie. You know?
Yeah, so Big Brother, I think, like you say, it's a kind of microcosm of the album, isn't it? All the themes of the album, they all come together here. It's got that incantatory feel to it. It's a bit like God by John Lennon at the end, where he's sort of like listing all these things which are defining his mental state at the moment. It's this sort of penultimate big statement.
Yes, absolutely. That's what I think it is. I think it is the final statement of intent before. I mean, it's not the closing track, obviously, because the closing track is slightly odd, brilliant, but odd. And I think this is the kind of high point musically of the record. Been building up, I think for me, it's been building up. It's a great record. I don't know if there's a bad track on it. But I think Big Brother will be there. Big Brother for me is the emotional core of the record. Yeah.
It's building up to the 2 minutes hate.
Absolutely, the 2 minutes hate. Yeah, I mean that's for people. Which
I've actually
is something...
got the ebook on my Kindle because I wanted to read to you a bit about the 2 minute hate and how this track is like the 2 minutes hate, because you know I think he said, I can't find it now, but it's something like it started with a grinding noise. It started with a you know, like a mechanical grinding noise, and it ends up with everybody chanting in this kind of delirium of ecstasy.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that. And of course, you're absolutely right. That's what it is. Because like the 2 minutes eight, this is a celebration of humanity at its most stupid and bizarre, isn't it?
Exactly.
I always think this track. It is a kind of weird. It's celebratory and it's also awful because it's saying that, yeah, this is humanity at its most animalized and stupid, isn't it? Yeah. The chant of the ever circling skeletal family. Yeah. Yeah, and it segues in as well, sort of slightly, doesn't it? And it's almost there's really nothing to it. It's, I suppose it's amongst the most up until he got to Low. I guess it's amongst the most avant-garde things
yeah,
he's ever done. Really,
it really
isn't
is. It really is. It's got such a dirty industrial vibe to it. Have you ever heard the Wedding Presents version?
I read about this the other day, and I cannot imagine the Wedding Presents version of this. Is it good?
Oh, it's great.
Is it? Oh, wow.
I remember in 92, they did a thing where they were putting a single out every month. And
yes.
The B-sides were covers. And then you got then they put out a collection of all the covers. They got some really strange ones. They did Come Up and See Me. They did Wild in the Country. They did this. They did Shaft. The theme from Shaft they did. Imagine David Gedge doing that. It was really, really good. But this was their Bowie cover. And also, just to go back to what you said earlier, in this you can hear the roots of, say, Sonic Youth or late 80s guitar indie, you know, that kind of really grungy driving. Just got to let the dog out. One sec. So we were talking about the chant of the ever-circling skeletal family and how I thought this was something to do with the 2 minutes hate.
2 minute hate. I've also been looking, I looked into this, and if you want to, you can find it online. Mm-hmm. I think it might be on that excellent, I think it might be, is it, I forgot the name of the website now. Is it Moving Away from the Dame or Pushing?
Oh, Pushing Ahead of the Dame, Chris Shaw's. Is it Chris Shaw? I think it's Chris Shaw.
We talked about it in the first part,
yes.
and in the intervening few months, I've forgotten the name of it, which is a shame because it is a fantastic resource for boy fans. And then from that, I wrote this down. I cut and pasted this. It's something of a rhythmic puzzle in alternate measures of 6/4 and 5/4, alternate bars of 2/4, then 3/4, and then in the six choruses, it moves completely to 5/4. Anyway, then there's quite a complicated musical analysis of it. The main thing, I guess, to say, well, one of the things to say about it, as well as the weird, almost cut-up techniques of the vocals, is how it ends, or rather doesn't end. The idea of it's emulating the locked groove on a record,
yeah.
isn't it? Which other people had done. People have done it as jokes. Sgt. Pepper does it, of course,
yeah.
and The Who Sellout does it. Apparently, I was reading this, that McCartney said the Beatles wanted to do that after they'd been at parties where people had listened to the ticking at the end of a record for 20 minutes because everyone was too stoned to get up and do anything. So the Beatles thought, well, if that's going to happen, we might as well put something music on and at least people have something to listen to for the 20 minutes.
That would drive you mad. That would drive you absolutely bonkers.
It would, you'd think so.
Sgt. Pepper.
Oh, it would drive you mad, wouldn't it? Yeah, it would. But this isn't quite the same because it's more. This is a bit of tape loopery going on, I think. So, but anyway, it certainly adds to that air of... Well, the nightmarish quality of it. And as you say, I hadn't thought about the 2 minute eight, but that's clearly what it's supposed to be, isn't it? And which makes you wonder, why didn't he call it the 2 minute eight again?
It would have been difficult, wouldn't it?
He might have thought it was a little bit too on the nose. He might have thought it'd be a little bit too, oh, I'm giving too much away, but what about the links between this and 1984? Because I think we should say, as we're getting to the end, I think we should say that while its roots are in 1984, it is not at all a slavish recreation of the story of 1984. It's not that at all, is it? It's not. The scenes of these records do not mirror the scenes of 1984, I don't think. Otherwise, you'd get a Room 101 moment. It is more a record inspired by the climate of 1984 and the ideas it explores. And you would also get, I imagine, somewhere along the line, a tender ballad about the proles, a sort of Chas and Dave-ish moment. About the process. I always think that this isn't, maybe because it was abandoned, you know, maybe because it was abandoned fairly early on, I would have thought, in the project, before he got everything done. I've always thought that it's not a record that's a slavish retelling of the 1984 story. It's a record that explores the world, the thought world, the ideas of 1984.
I so wish he'd got Chas and Dave on board to do
To do the Voice of the Proles. Yeah, it'd be great, yeah, wouldn't it?
It would have been great. It'd been something like London Girls he could have done. Or,
yeah. Yeah. But I don't think, maybe you didn't call it 2 minutes eight because that's a very intelligent point you made. And it does seem to me to be the 2 minutes eight. But maybe you thought it would be a little too on the nose to call it that. Calling it Chant of the Ever Circling Skeletal Family puts you in a different direction, doesn't it? I think it's the idea that humanity in all its horribleness goes on and on and on, getting more horrible and stupid. I don't know.
Yeah, definitely ever circling the lock groove at the end. It's a chance. It's something. I mean, it just occurred to me. I was skimming through 1984 the other night, just to see what I could pick up on this. And that thing about the mechanical grinding at the beginning of the 2 minutes eight, and then the kind of ecstatic chance at the end. Everything. Yeah, definitely. I think there's a strong correlation there, but. In broader terms, like you're saying, if we kind of pull back the focus a little bit and look at this album as a whole,
you're absolutely right.
It isn't like it begins with the clock striking 13 and ends up with Winston Smith in his little bar drinking and saying he loves Big Brother. There isn't that straight representation of the narrative arc, but rather he delves in and extracts the spirit. He extracts the tensions, the darkness, the ideas underlying the narrative of 1984.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think he has started to think about all these things, maybe because of his trip through the Soviet bloc, because of 1984, he started to think about all these things. And you've got to see it as well in terms of where Britain, where the world was in 1974. People thought that Britain was on the, you know, some people thought that Britain was on the verge of something either from the right or the left, some kind of coup. You know, they were much less consensual times, really. And I think that these ideas have been swirling around his head. And of course, we can't underestimate it. Taking all that cocaine is bound to mess with your head a little. And all this is swirling together in this amazing record. Probably his darkest record, would you say?
Definitely, up until Black Star. Outside. I mean, there's a lot of parallels between this record and Outside, you know, in terms of the loose concept, in terms of the very black dynamics of the narratives and the lyrics. Yeah, but it's for its time, like you say, 1974 was not, late 73, early 74 was not an easy time in Britain. There was a lot of tension, a lot of worry, and... Well, I mean, right now we're living through an unprecedented period of tension and worry and uncertainty. But certainly then, to go back to the beginning of our conversation today, when you said it, there's a certain resonance to that album now, you know, it's true.
Oh, absolutely.
It articulates that beautifully. On a completely different note, just I'm interested, who are the artists you feel who are working today that could make a Diamond Dogs for the future? Who are the artists?
That's a very interesting point. One of my slight worries about rock music, I wouldn't want to speak for all kinds of music. I'm not sufficiently expert in what happens in grime and R&B. Although grime would seem to me, thinking about it, a grime artist. Yeah. You think Stormzy could make a Diamond Dogs, wouldn't you? It's perfectly... Because grime... It's not the same sound world, but it's the same world of ideas about the paranoia and terror of urban life.
Definitely.
But I do think that Tranquility Bay Hotel and Casino is a kind of Diamond Dogs record. It's the work of a young... It got absolutely, I think, slated wrongly by the press when it came out because it dared to be ambitious. We once upon a time used to think ambition was a good thing. I wonder what people would say about David Bowie's records now, because I think some people just aren't willing to embrace it anymore. And I think there was a certain snobbery about that record, about the Arctic Monkeys records. People basically saying, you're a bit of an upstart indie kid from Sheffield. Why are you making this record? But I think, you know, if you read Alex Turner's interviews, the books he'd been reading, I mean, he'd been reading books like Amusing Ourselves to Death and books about modern media, semiotics and things like that. But it's the same kind of idea, I think. It's a young rock and roller who's trying to make an intelligent record. And it's got that same... what's brilliant about Diamond Dogs as well, sorry to slightly not answer your question, is if you didn't know it that... If you don't know Diamond Dogs that well, you've only got a cursory knowledge of Bowie's catalogue, I think you'll not understand how great and complicated and deep a record it is, because you'll see the picture on the front and you'll know Rebel Rebel, you know, and you'll go... it's a glam rock, you know, it's a sexy, weird, painted, made-up glam rock record. It's got Bowie on the front looking like a dog and a woman, and it's got Rebel Rebel on it. and you'll think you know it, but you don't really. I don't think you'll know the depth of the record, the darkness and depth of the record. So I don't know. As much as I loathe him because of his personal idiocies, you know, maybe Kanye West could make Diamond Dogs. I don't know. I don't know.
This is one man's alarmed vision of the future. A future which he felt might, with such dangerous ease, be brought about. This, in 1984, is London, chief city of Airstrip 1, a province of the state of Oceania.
And that was Stuart McConey speaking to me from across the country, and many, many thanks to him for a fantastic discussion, which thoroughly enjoyable. I had a wonderful time talking to him. I hope you enjoyed it too, and stay tuned for the next edition of Album to Album coming up soon. In the meantime, take care, stay safe, and we'll be together very soon. Bye-bye.